Thanks for joining us today on our regular home improvement show. Larry Mueller here with my guest, John Freiberger. John's a registered home inspector, more than 50 years experience in the trade. He specializes in restoring older homes. That's one of the things he really likes to do. And we're going to be talking with John about your home's exterior, at least to begin the show, and we want to hear from you. What's your house roof look like? Is it time to replace the siding? Join in. The number's 800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. Or send an email to talk@wpr.org. John, welcome back. Great to have you with us once again.
Great to be here again.
Let's take a long look here, a broad look at things to consider when you're talking about parts of your home exterior, mm-hmm. like the siding or roofing. What do you want to take into account?
Well, generally, siding and roofing is something we are not going to do ourselves.
Yep.
So we're going to pick out a product, a look that we like, something that makes us happy after we write the big check, but we got to write that big check to somebody. And I'm finding a lot of problems out there in roofing and siding. A lot of misinstallation, bad installation, things that are leaving clients unhappy. So once you pick out a product for, you know, the looks, because mm-hmm. you want your house to look good, then you need to do some research. I would never sign a contract with anybody unless I had already reviewed the installation instructions from the manufacturer. So we've got to be informed consumers, especially, Larry, with the inflation that we are seeing in the construction industry. And now with tariffs with Canada, a lot of wood products are going to be much more expensive, although we don't use a lot of wood products anymore. But even the manufactured products that we see, you know, the Trespa, the LP, the vinyl siding, the high-pressure laminate sidings are yeah. out there. It's amazing what is out there. It isn't just vinyl siding. So everybody needs to research to have really a program of here's what I want, here's how it is to be installed. I've got to talk to the right contractor. And as I often say on the air, if you're using LP, download the instructions on the LP website, print two copies, and hand one to the contractor. And make sure he knows or she knows that you have it.
Well, I know you wanted to talk about rain screens today. Someone might say, well, what's a rain screen and why should I be concerned about it?
Right. And we have some sidings are rain screen just because of the way they are. So if you're putting new vinyl siding on your house, you're going to probably take off the old siding or maybe not. But you are going to put a weather-resistant barrier on the house, a Tyvek, a Henry, a Typar, a Kimberly-Clark Bloxit, a something or other that is going to make your wall and the interfaces with your windows and doors completely waterproof. And that is our barrier. So vinyl siding, if you take a look at the bottom of the vinyl siding, there's holes in it. Now, the holes are there so the water can run out. Because vinyl siding is a natural rain screen. It leaks, and it is designed to leak. What it does is it breaks up the wind and water pressure so that the weather-resistant barrier isn't hit by all of that pressure, and then it slowly drains things down and drains out the bottom. Now, if we're putting on let's say you've got a really nice, 1950s architect-designed modern house, and you want to put on Trespa panels, you know, the high-pressure laminate panels, mm-hmm. then what you're going to do is you're going to put on your weather-resistant barrier, and then you're going to fur the wall out by at least 3/8 of an inch, like with rip plywood or even with metal furring, which they make. They make an S-type metal furring. And then you're going to put on your Trespa panels, and where they leak, you don't care. Because just like having vinyl siding on your house, the barrier is behind the siding. The siding is acting. Think of a window screen on your window, Larry. The water hits it, you know, the big thunderstorm, a little bit of water drips to the inside, keeps most of it out. That's the same way your siding is going to work.
There you go. Well, we've got a question from Rich in Manitowoc that kind of relates to this, I believe. Rich, what's on your mind?
I got a 1910 two-family with aluminum siding, and the lower unit kitchen protrudes out a little ways where there's a rubber membrane roof on top of it, and there's a door access to that on the top unit. For years, I've had different people come to look at it, different contractors. They'll put a new rubber membrane up there. They'll caulk and seal everything. And then with a good east wind and some rain, water gets forced through the side of the house somewhere and drips through the lower unit light fixture, which is like a soffit built up around the cabinets. And right now I'm ripping that out and repairing it again. And I just had the all the other stuff redone, re-caulked and sealed. And we just can't seem to get to the bottom of the problem.
Well, I would expect that we have a problem on your 1910 that when they put the aluminum siding on, do you know what they put in back of the aluminum siding? Is it old-fashioned tar paper?
It looks like some kind of fiberboard from what I can see.
Okay. Yes, and the fiberboard really isn't a weather-resistant barrier. In fact, it's fairly heavy sponge. So I think what's happening is, so just like vinyl siding, most metal sidings are also a rain screen. They are designed to leak. Now, you can take a look at the bottom of your metal siding and see if you see drain holes. If it's fairly new metal siding, it's going to have drain holes. If it's really old, it might not. Stuff from the 50s and 60s often didn't have drain holes. But I'm afraid that what your problem is, Rich, is you simply don't have a weather barrier on the house. How old is this metal siding? Is it something you're thinking of changing in the next decade?
Well, it's in good shape, and I didn't want to rip it off and replace it because all the newer stuff to me, I don't know, maybe it's time to replace the aluminum siding. I don't know.
Well, it's also possible because aluminum siding, like vinyl siding, is not nailed tight. It's nailed into little slots, and when it expands and contracts in the heat or the cold, it's got to be able to slide past the nail. So you may find that you could actually very carefully remove all the siding on that side of the house, put a weather-resistant barrier up, and then put the siding back up. That'd be a real great way of preserving resources.
Yeah.
You might have to paint it, but that's fine. You paint it, and it's good for another 20, 30 years. But take a look. Go to the DuPont website and take a look at the Tyvek residential installation instructions. That's going to give you a whole bunch of illustrations and make you familiar with weather-resistant barriers. Now, I usually mention DuPont Tyvek not because I'm endorsing it, but it is a good product, but because it is the most common one out there. When you drive through the suburbs and you see the new houses, you see lots of blue Tyvek labels. So, but they do have a good website. They have a lot of information for you, and they also have a good technical staff that if you email them or call them with a question, they will send it to their Wisconsin expert in Wauwatosa, and she will answer it for you very carefully.
Yeah. Rich, there you go. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in, too. Number to call, 800-642-1234. Email to talk@WPR.org. Let's take a look at the roof. You know, different kinds of roofs. We got shingle, we got slate, you got tile, you got copper, you got metal. So there's lots of different types here. What are the pros and cons of metal?
Well, the first thing we have to do is take a look at what kind of shape our house is in, and literally the shape of the roof. So if you've got an 1880s house and the rafters are pretty light, and you look out from the street and you hold a pencil up along the ridge, and you see that there's a 3 or 4 inch sag in that roof, which is not unusual and it's not necessarily a structural problem, you do not want to try to put standing seam metal roofing on that. But we have metal shingles that go on just like shingles. So if the roof's a little crooked, we can use them. We have some new things, too, Larry. They're pretty interesting. So it's actually a metal shingle that's got a coating on it, and then it has granules on it, just like an asphalt shingle.
Oh.
And they're really tough, very weather resistant. They're expected to have a life of at least 50 years and maybe 80. So there's a lot of things out there. You just have to basically go to Google, type in metal roofs, and you'll probably get 10 or 15 manufacturers with different types. And we always tend to think about sheet metal. And some of it is just overlap metal with screws. Don't put that on. That's good for a barn. Don't put it on your house because you've got penetration. The standing seam is expensive, but it's really the way to go, and that is a 50 to 80-year roof if you can afford it. The other thing that we're seeing a lot of, Larry, and because it's been the news the last year, is needing to do fire-retardant cladding and roofing on our houses.
Hmm.
And, of course, metal is fire-retardant. You know, embers will fall on the roof that won't necessarily burn through, especially if the metal is spaced off the old roof by 3/8 or 1/4 inch, so we actually have an air gap underneath. And that is the best way of doing it. So if you're in northern Wisconsin and we get a terrible drought and the forest near you burns, if you've got a good quality metal roof on, you're much less likely to have to file an insurance claim.
Hmm. And speaking of insurance claims, I've got a notice from my insurance company, and I think a lot of other insurance companies were sending out similar letters that due to the climate change and the severe storms that can hit, they were adjusting the rate.
Yes. Yes, I with tears in my eyes, wrote the check after receiving the same letter.
Oh, boy.
So we need to be proactive. And when we think about siding, if we're in northern Wisconsin in the woods, I would not put vinyl siding on my house.
No.
I mean, it's plastic.
Yeah.
It melts and it burns. There are fire-retardant treated sidings out there now. Thermalwood has a hemlock or a hem-fir siding that is a real wood siding. You can put it up as a rain screen so it lasts almost forever. But it is fire-retardant. So do some investigation if you're in a fire area so that all that money you spend not only makes your house look pretty and maintainable, but also makes it more fireproof. And, of course, then you call your insurance company and say, you know something? My house needs a lower premium because it's fire-retardant.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Don in Appleton has a question for you. Let's go there. Hi, Don.
Hello, Larry. Thanks for taking my call. I was wondering what is the thoughts on putting insulation on the outside of the wall before you do your siding? And how do you manage moisture in your wall assembly when you do that?
Real good question, Don. And we call it outsolation. And I recommend it a lot. What you want to do, depending upon the age of your house, if you've got an older house up in Appleton, Don, you probably don't have a vapor barrier. So the humidity in your house, especially in the winter, can go into the walls, and when it hits the dew point, it can condense out or even freeze. And we don't want to rip off all the plaster and drywall in your house to put up a vapor barrier. And the vapor barrier paints work, but sort of, not really. So if we're going to put insulation on our house, you want to try to put enough insulation on the exterior so that the inside of the wall stays so warm it is above the dew point. So you never get condensation in there. So the place where the dew point temperature is someplace out in that foam layer that you've put on as insulation. And, of course, no water can get there because it's closed-cell foam. So, therefore, no matter how wet your house is, almost no matter how wet, but you are not going to have the winter condensation and mold problems that we have so frequently in Wisconsin on older houses. So what you can take a look at is putting on probably 3 inches of closed-cell foam. That is usually put on with long screws. And then what I would do is I would have a weather-resistant barrier, preferably on the house before the foam is put on. The foam itself, if you overlap the joints and tape them, is a second weather-resistant barrier. So basically, we call that belt and suspenders.
Yeah.
You are not going to get water through the walls. You have to be careful where your existing windows and doors are to figure that out. But then you can have the long screws that attach the foam, and they can be run actually through ripped 3/8-inch plywood. And then any type of siding you want to put on the exterior of that, be it vinyl, metal, wood, is going to work for you. You're going to have a very warm home. It's going to be very waterproof. It's going to be very windproof. And think about, you know, when you hit the foundation and things, what do we need to do there? Do we need to add some insulation at the foundation? Are we going to vent this airspace up into the attic so we don't have to use soffit vents up there? So do a little planning. You might have to talk to a designer or an architect, but it certainly is a great way of retrofitting a house for much higher efficiency and for reduced maintenance and very long life.
There you go, Don. Thank you so much for calling, taking a look at home renovation and repair. We've zeroed in a little on siding and roofing materials, but probably can take some other questions as well with our guest, John Freiberger, registered home inspector of Freiberger and Associates of Fitchburg. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Taking a look at home renovation and repair on the show today. At 12:30, I should mention, we'll talk about two very successful women's hockey teams in our state, both NCAA champions. It's going to be fun to talk with coaches about those teams. Right now, John Freiberger answering your home renovation questions. And Peter in central Wisconsin, we'll go to you. Hi, Peter.
Hello. Hey, I'm calling. I got a 30-year shingle on my house, and it's 15 years. It's been on 15 years. I just got a notification from my insurance company. They're going to raise my rates because it's over 10 years old.
Yes, I've had several calls from people.
You've had? Oh, you have?
Yes, I have, where they're saying, hey, I bought a 40-year GAF or I bought a lifetime guaranteed GAF. Peter, I have not investigated this, but why don't you? And what I would do is call that shingle manufacturer. Do you know who it was?
Yeah.
Call them. Call them. Ask about the warranty. Ask them what you should do with the insurance company. Can they write a letter to you? They may say, Peter, you got to take some photos of it, etc. But they may be able to save the situation for you. I really don't know. But give that a try.
It's worth it. Yeah.
And yeah, if it works, the next time I'm on, or next month when the other home inspector, home improvement people are on, give Larry a call and say, guess what? It worked. Or call and say, it didn't. But you are correct. We're advising people to put on good quality shingles, because the higher the quality of shingles, the more UV resistant they have and the more wind resistance they have. And I think I just saw a news article saying that the spring in the United States is the windiest spring we've ever had. Oh. So here we go. We pay for quality, and then the insurance company comes after us, and it really isn't fair. So we need to figure out a way of doing this.
I like that idea a lot, getting a hold of the company itself. Peter, good luck with that. Yeah, let us know. Well, save it for 2 months from now. By that it'll be all. You can call back and let us know how that worked. Appreciate it. Jim in Verona, your turn. Hi, Jim.
Hi, Larry. Hi, John. I got a question, two questions. One about a chimney. We're going to put on a new roof on an old Craftsman house. And how far down should we go with that chimney removal? It's a soffit and cobra vented attic.
Sure. One thing I always like you to tell people to think about, Jim, is what could you do with the space if you completely remove that chimney? So you've got an old Craftsman house. You probably have no high returns. So the air conditioning probably works pretty poorly in the summer. So if we end up taking the whole chimney out, we've got a place where we can put in heat return ducts, heat supply ducts, plumbing, electrical wiring, almost anything. I usually tell people, take it down at least past the second floor so we can air seal the hole in the attic. But in many cases, it doesn't cost a lot more to take it down into the basement, and that can give you this nice hole in your house that you can use for some productive manner.
Yeah. I had a friend do it by himself, brick by brick. not everybody would want to do that. He's pretty handy and also strong. I wouldn't do it myself. But, Jim, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. And open lines get you on pretty quickly at 800-642-1234. Email to talk@WPR.org. Joe emailed us. He has a sound mid-range asphalt shingle or shingles with decent mineral coating, etc., and is wondering if any of the newer recoatings professionally applied might be helpful in extending the roof life. And he has a separate building shaded by trees slated to come down. Can you suggest any reflective coatings to reduce heat gain that can be owner applied?
Most shingles are designed for climates a lot worse than Wisconsin as far as heat and sun. So, you know, you see the same shingles here that you see in Florida. So I don't think there's a lot of improvement to be made. I always worry about coatings because a coating is a liquid applied. It sort of gives you a sheet. Shingles are meant to move, which is why they have the tabs and the spaces in between, because they expand and contract like anything else. I think I would probably avoid applying anything to them.
Okay.
I don't know of anything that improves the life of a shingle.
We know a lot of things that will go the other way.
Yes.
With shingles. Dale emailed us. Their house is quite dusty. Dale could dust the same surface every other day, trying to keep them looking reasonably nice. Does duct cleaning help with this? He says he regularly replaces the furnace filter, has had the installation reblown to R60, and his dryer vent is sealed correctly.
Mm-hmm. Well, he changes the furnace filter, but what's the rating on the furnace filter? And is this furnace powerful enough we can actually put a HEPA filter on it? Most furnaces aren't. But we can go to MERV 11 or MERV 13, which is the minimum efficiency. And if you look up MERV, it'll tell you exactly the size of the particles it takes out of the air. And I think that I'm trying to visualize the tables, Larry, but I think a MERV 11 takes out like 40% of the particles. A MERV 13 takes out 60%. So, and if we've got just this hardware store sort of filters, that picks up the big cat hair, and that's about it. Those are designed to keep the furnace relatively clean, not designed to clean the air. So take a look at the type of filter. If you do not have a good filter and you're going to put a good filter in, then, yes, do the duct cleaning because you've got a lot of dirt in the duct, and that is still going to get blown out from the air movement, even though the air that's moving is clean when it comes through the furnace.
Yeah, that makes good sense. Would you need to take a look at the make and model of your furnace and then go online and look and see what it would accept or, you know, recommendations on that along that line for filters I'm talking
about? Yes, certainly for a HEPA filter you would. I know of very few furnaces that will not handle a MERV 13 at this point, and that's a filter you can pick up almost anywhere, but of course you have to have the right size filter box. And sometimes when you have changed from the little 1-inch wide filters to the 6-inch wide filters, your HVAC technician has to come in and redo a little bit of work on the return air duct.
Oh, and he just sent us an email, another follow-up email, and he says he uses 4-inch thick AprilAire MERV 16s.
Oh, well, then that is a little bit unusual. The question is, how old is the house, and what do we have for insulation in the walls? If we have a cellulose-type insulation in the walls, we could be getting dust in the house out of the insulation in the walls. Or the ducts are very, very dirty, and we need to clean the ducts.
Yeah, probably. Looks like one of those situations where duct cleaning wouldn't hurt at all.
Right. It's certainly not going to hurt anything.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Tom and Rhinelander, hi. Thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
I'm calling to answer your question regarding roofing. I've heard one particular home repair expert has several times over the last number of years recommended a copper strip along the top of the roof line when you have regular shingles, and the idea being something to the effect of the copper strip releases ions that are good for the shingles. Can you tell me more about that?
Sure, Tom. You are correct. If you remember, if you drive out in the country and look at the old farmhouses that have old roofs on them, often you'll see this ornate metalwork up at the ridge of the roof, and a lot of that was zinc-coated galvanized metal. And that was put up there to do the same thing that the copper is doing. It's releasing zinc, some sort. I don't know the exact chemical composition, what comes off. But I know on my house where I have a very expensive cedar sawn shingle roof, I have a strip, a zinc strip, every six rows of shingles. And it does not completely cure non-green plant growth on your roof, but it does certainly help. But you are correct, Tom, that is an old technique. It's a 150, 200-year-old technique to help make your roofs last longer.
Yeah. You wonder who thought that up to begin with. It'd be fun to know the history of that. Tom, there you go. Thank you for calling. We've got a question from Nick in Green Bay next. Hi, Nick.
Hi. Just a little backstory about my house. It's a 1950s house. Before we bought it, they had to secure the foundation, fix the foundation. And I was under the assumption that when they fixed the foundation, they waterproofed it, but they did not. And they put an extra sump pump in, which is great, but I still got a wet basement.
Mm-hmm.
Is it pretty easy to waterproof that? Can I do that myself, or
no.
Am I pushed?
No, they'll try to sell you a lot of stuff, and the only guarantee that I'll give you on it is that it won't work. What you have to do when you waterproof is you have to think of water pressure like wind pressure. It's pushing, right? And so it's pushing through your block or your concrete, and then when that pressure hits whatever you've applied on the inside, it just makes it blister and fall off. So unfortunately, the only way we can really waterproof a house is to do it from the outside. And I know of no way of doing it other than doing a whole lot of excavating. Now, the other things to take a look at Nick, are the grade around the house, your gutters, the gutter extensions, etc. You need to have a half inch per foot for 10 feet slope away from the house. So that's 5 inches in 10 feet. You need to make sure that your gutters are the right size so they're actually capturing all the rain coming off the roof. And considering how it rains in Wisconsin now, a lot of people are upsizing their gutters. We have to make sure that the downspout extensions are away from the house. So I would do some of those things first. But remember, don't get the dirt right up to the siding. You should have 6 to 8 inches of clearance between the soil and the bottom of the siding. So take a look at your grading first. Let's do some things that are inexpensive before we even think about trying to dig up a whole foundation.
Yeah, I extended the downspout. When I moved into the house, there was a little leakage coming there. I extended the downspout about 3 feet, and that was 12 years ago or so, and I haven't had a problem since.
You can figure usually about a 45-degree angle from the edge of the downspout, and if you draw that angle, it should come in underneath the foundation and not meet your wall.
Yeah. There you go. There you go, Nick. Thank you for calling. Linda in Appleton, your turn. Hi, Linda.
Hi, guys. Hey, I really appreciate your program, and thanks for coming on every month, John. I live in an older brick house, mid-1930s, 1935-ish brick, Cape Cod style with dormers. And I've scheduled window painting and glazing because they are the original windows.
Mm-hmm.
And they're in the living room, dining room area, you know, traditional. There's a bank of windows, and in each bank, there are three windows. And there are three of those, you know, between the two rooms.
Mm-hmm.
Is it better to put my money toward the continued maintenance and glazing? They laughed when I said, do you know how to glaze windows? He says, I didn't think anybody did that anymore. And so to continue with a maintenance like that, or to investigate new windows. They're double, you know, so you know, they're never taken off except for a painting.
Mm-hmm.
Live on a major highway, and it's recessed back a little bit, so they don't get real dirty.
Mm-hmm.
We've always done other windows in the home, Marvin windows, and mm-hmm. they've always been good for us. We've been in the home for 38 years.
Mm-hmm.
Third owner.
Yes. The problem with replacing windows is the cost of replacing windows. And it is now astronomical. Marvin is a very good brand. I know a typical double hung from Marvin right now, say a 30-inch by a 54, is about $2,600.
Woo.
So let's take that three, we'll multiply that by nine. So before, just to get the windows delivered and off the truck, we're at $20-some thousand dollars. I think doing a lot of maintenance on these old windows, which are much better quality wood than we can get even from Marvin, a good quality manufacturer today. So if these windows are not actively failing, I would use whatever you need to keep them going. Now, we've got wonderful wood hardeners and other things out there, so if we have some soft spots, we can take care of it. But let's maintain what we have rather than spend the amount of money. Now, there are people out there that are going to sell you cheap vinyl windows, but they are cheap in every meaning of the word. So I really would want to compare your good quality 1930s windows with something like a Marvin or an Anderson 400 series or something like that. And all of those are frightfully expensive.
Yeah.
So let's do maintenance.
All right, Linda, there you go. Thank you for calling. And on to Terry in Rome, Wisconsin. Hi, Terry.
Yeah, hi, good morning. Regarding waterproofing a basement wall where you've got some moisture or water problems, in the past on at least three of my children's homes, what I've done is I've excavated along the side of the house about a foot and a half to 2 feet down by the wall, and then out on a slight angle, maybe a 5 to 10 degree angle away from the house, out about 3 to 4 feet, and then I lay 6 mil plastic down up against the house with some tar on the brick, and then the 6 mil plastic up against the tar, and then the plastic down away from the house, draining away from the house at least 3 to 4 feet.
Mm-hmm.
And at least in the ones that I've done, without going all the way down to the bottom, that's eliminated the problem.
That's a really good idea, Terry, and I'm just going to add a couple things to it, though. You've already done the hard work. You've done the excavation. So we're putting down this plastic. Why aren't we insulating at the same time? Because we can insulate the vertical part of the wall that you have unearthed, plus we should insulate that area where you're laying the plastic at an angle, because that works. So if we're going to go through all this work of digging, putting down the plastic, let's go ahead and put closed cell foam, which again is waterproof, just like the plastic. So we get a tear in the plastic. We've got the backup of the foam. And then above grade, we'll have to coat that foam with a cementous coating or one of the rollout type coatings. But if you're doing all of that work, I would go ahead and get a little bit of extra return for your hard work by thinking about insulating. But you're right. That is a real good way. As long as we don't have hydrostatic head pressure, if this is moisture from the surface that is going down and coming into the house, your system does a good job of that. But if we have hydrostatic head pressure simply coming up because the water table is coming up when it rains like heck in April and May, it won't solve that, but it's certainly going to help any house. And if we add the insulation, that's extra help.
Yeah. Terry, thanks. Appreciate the call very much. And we'll go to Kathy in Minnesota. Hi, Kathy.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, I have a question. My son lives in Arkansas, Northwest Arkansas. He lives in the city, but his house is on a mountain, so he's kind of halfway up on a switchback.
Mm-hmm.
And he was having some furnace maintenance done, and they recommended a UV light for his HVAC system, and neither of us are familiar with that. Do you have any reason or what they would install?
Yeah,
that
what they're selling you is something that is supposed to kill fungus and germs and things. And I don't know of any scientific studies, although the manufacturer probably has one from his cousin Fred, who happens to be a scientist, that says it works. I have heard of people using them. I don't know of any literature that says that they have any real effect compared to putting in a really good quality filter.
Hmm.
So because a filter, a HEPA type filter, is going to stop things like mold spores. So I think I would go to the filtration route. I know that if you read the fine print on the ultraviolet, is the lamp is good for X weeks or X months, and then you have to replace it. If you don't replace it, it's on but doesn't do anything. So it's an extra cost. It's an extra headache. And I'm not sure there's a good return on investment.
All right. Kathy, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. And you can join in, too. Number to call, 800-642-1234. Or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. Give us a call. Get you on pretty quickly at that number, 800-642-1234. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you along today on WPR News as we talk home maintenance and repair with John Freiberger of Freiberger and Associates. Larry Mueller here. Just a quick mention, tomorrow on Garden Talk, we have some tips to help you tackle your garden chores, and we'll be hearing more about the pawpaw fruit tree. I don't know a lot about pawpaw, so I guess I'll learn a little tomorrow. I'm learning now a lot about home maintenance and repair with John, and lots of callers online and a bunch of emails. Veronica emailed to say she wants to put up a small garden shed, you know, 4x6 roughly, and wonders about materials. She has a Victorian home, doesn't really want metal. What are your thoughts on manufactured wood, and what brands are best?
Well, we don't have a lot to go on here, Larry. we'll just talk about siding just a little. She has a Victorian home. She probably has a wood lap siding. And it could be a narrow lap or it could be a larger lap. It might probably be a 5 or 5.5 inch on most Victorian homes, though some of them have a little tiny 2.5. So we can match that with cementous siding, like James Hardie Company cement board. We can probably match that with some sort of LP siding. The important thing, again, is that we're doing a garden shed, so this has to have something to support it. And it's probably going to be treated wood or something, because it's probably just going to be sitting on the ground, or maybe there will be some piles put into the ground, posts, mm-hmm. and it'll be resting on the post. And we have to make sure that whatever we use for siding there is at least 6 inches and preferably 8 inches out of grade. So then we need something to cover that bottom part, and that can't be cementous siding, because cementous siding needs 6 inches. So we have to come up with something for that. That could be closed cell foam with a cement covering on it, which mm-hmm. would sort of look like a foundation. So I think, I wish I had a picture because I could say a little bit more. But there are a lot of things out there. Veronica, maybe shoot me an email and shoot me a picture. And then I can say, here's a couple
picture
things.
Picture of her house?
A picture of your house and a picture of where you want the shed to be. And I don't know if this is a freestanding shed, if this is going to be a shed that's against the house. So we need a lot more information to be able to give Veronica any real advice. But I always tell our listeners, feel free to email me at frei@chorus.net, and I'm always happy to answer your questions. Chorus is spelled like a group of singers, C-H-O-R-U-S.
Bill in Green Bay has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Bill.
Yeah, it's actually not a question. It's actually just a comment to help everybody that's going to be putting a roof on this summer. So my advice would either be to take a day off work and kind of be around so you can see what's happening, or if you can't do that, see if the roofer is willing to take some pictures for you of every section they take off and re-roof. There's some really good roofers out there, and there's some people that should not be putting roofs on houses for people. So I did a little detective work one night after I had a roof put on because I had to leave for a funeral for a few hours. And sure enough, all four sides had a little different. Some was putting the edging on different. The other side of the house, they were going underneath the T-edging. One side, they were going over. Lo and behold, crawled up in the attic the next day, found a leak when it was raining. So that's another thing. After you have a roof put on, I would definitely go take a peek up in the attic after and make sure you don't have any issues. They ended up tearing the whole roof back off, which I commend them for that, and redoing it the right way. But when they did it, when I was gone for those few hours, there was a section of the roof they did not even put the felt paper on.
Oh, well.
Yeah. Now, thank you for that call, Bill. This is why I tell everybody, I mean, even roofing, if you're put on GAF or CertainTeed shingles, go to the website, download the installation instructions, and don't go in the attic after the roof is put on. Go into the attic before the roof is put on. Because if you've got some decayed sheathing, especially if you have like OSB or some of the the Wuzzwood sheathing, you may need to bring that to the attention of the roofer, say that I think I've got four sheets that are going to have to be replaced. What are you going to replace it with? How are you going to fasten it, et cetera? So make sure that the guy just doesn't drive by, do a quick measure, and leave. One thing that I'm finding, Bill, and I'm so glad this guy stood behind you, and a lot of them do. A lot of them actually will acknowledge a mistake. But we see a lot of discount things, you know, 5 years free financing, blah, 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 in the Sunday papers. My concern is that anybody who doesn't have enough work, who's advertising in the Sunday papers, there's a reason they don't have enough work. And so that worries me a little bit. So really check out references, download installation instructions, pre-inspect your attic, and also take a look at things. If you have a chimney, how is a chimney supposed to be flashed?
Yeah,
you can go to masonry sites and see how to flash a chimney. All of this stuff is available online for us now. We just need to do some research so that the dollars that we spend give us 100 cents in return.
John in Reeseville will give you a shot. Hi, John.
Hi, Larry. I had a follow-up to the person who called earlier about protecting the foundation by putting down...
Oh.
That. And
we lost you there.
Can you hear me now?
Can hear you now.
Sorry about that. I'm on the road. Earlier caller was describing putting plastic down to protect their foundation.
Right.
And you mentioned adding insulation to that. And then you said the one problem that won't fix is if you have hydrostatic pressure from the high water table. How do we know if we have that problem?
Generally, what is going to happen is we will get the leaking in the basement post rain, not during the rain. So if it's leaking near the surface, it's going to go to the surface quick. But if it's got to sink down for 5-6 feet, it takes a while. Now, one thing we can do is we can inspect our basements. We have this thing called efflorescence. It's a white powder on concrete block. Is great. It's really easy to inspect concrete block because you can see the efflorescence. So if there's efflorescence high on the wall and not low on the wall, then our friend Terry has got the solution for 100%. But if the efflorescence is low on the wall, the last two blocks down and not high on the wall, then we probably have hydrostatic head pressure at the water table is coming up. Now, we can find the same thing with concrete. Concrete, we have snap ties through the wall, the iron ties. We see where they're rusting or where they're leaking. Look at the cracks. Where is the water coming in? Is it high? Is it low? Or is it all over the whole wall, which it could be? But somebody knowledgeable taking a look at your basement, and you know, you can always call a local home inspector because they're trained to do this. You can go to the Wisconsin Association of Home Inspectors website or the InterNACHI website, download whoever the local inspectors are in your area and say, I've got a basement problem. Can you tell me where the water is coming from? And one of those men or women is going to say, yep, I'll come over and look at that for you.
Good points. John, good luck. Thank you. Dan in Edgerton, your turn. Hi, Dan.
Hello. I have a question about replacing 20-year-old shingles. I have no clue what the quality is because we just bought the house years ago. And so we're thinking maybe a metal roof might last longer, but have no clue how to start researching that.
Well, there are actually a couple of decent things online that will give you the relative life of the different roofs. I wish I could name the website for you, but I think if you do a Google search on types of shingles and expected lifespans, and many of these, because I looked at a couple of them, you know, there's always things, new things to look. You know, I haven't used these granular coated metal shingles, so I went online and looked at them. So go online and look, and I think you'll probably get some fairly decent advice. Certainly, a metal roof is one of the longest lasting roofs you can get, but again, it depends upon the quality. So if you're getting it from Smith Brothers Metal, whoever that is, you want to go online and you want to see what their warranty is. Very thin metal roofs will dent. Thicker gauge metal roofs will not dent. So even within whatever you pick, you know, asphalt roof, metal roof, whatever, take a look at the quality and take a look at the guarantees. Certainly there are companies like GAF I know will give you a 40-year and I think even a 50-year and even a lifetime warranty on some of their shingles. And I'm sure that you'll find metal shingle and standing seam roofs that'll offer you similar life. But I've heard of a lot of metal roofs going 80 years.
Oh. Dan, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call very much. And Mary in Arcana Falls, what's on your mind?
Hi, I'm just wondering, I've been seeing some advertisements on television for a product that they spray on your roof, and I'm wondering, it says it's supposed to make your roof last a lot longer. Is that true or not? Or?
Well, it depends. There are some products that will work on wood roofs to resist moss and, you know, green and non-green plant growth. As far as asphalt roofs, I'd be very worried about adding a chemical to it. The nice thing about wood roofs is they're very resistant. An asphalt roof, depending upon exactly how the shingle is manufactured, it would worry me a little bit. And, Mary, I haven't seen the advertisement, so I'm not exactly sure what they're trying to sell. It could be like a zinc or copper oxide spray or something like that that actually might do something. But, of course, if it washes off, it's doing it for a couple of weeks, you know, versus using the metal strips or the metal caps. So I'm afraid I can't add any more knowledge to that, Mary.
All right. Thank you, Mary, for calling. Jane emailed and wondered, can you remove asbestos from your home on your own?
No. Now that let me clarify, Larry. What's the type of asbestos? If it's the old asbestos siding, that's non-friable. And I believe you'd have to go online to check the rules. But I believe that a contractor can remove that, and that can be put in a regular landfill. If this is the type of asbestos we use around old heating ducts, that is friable asbestos. That has to go to a separate landfill and has to be taken off by somebody who is certified for asbestos. And there are remediation people who are certified for mold, but not for asbestos. So the easiest thing to do, Jane, is to go to, you know, the local internet, find somebody who is certified in asbestos, have them come and give them you a quote, and just ask the question, is it friable, is it non-friable? Do you have to be certified? Give me a copy of your certification. Need a copy of your insurance, et cetera, et cetera.
John Freiberger, our guest today, as we talk home renovation and repair. And he'll be with us right up until 12:30 today. And at 12:30, we'll be talking with a couple of very successful women's hockey program coaches. It'll be great to visit with them as well at 12:30. But right now, until 12:30, you got John. I'm Larry Mueller.
Taking a look at home renovation and repair today on the show, Larry Mueller here with my guest, John Freiberger, Wisconsin registered home inspector, and his firm, Freiberger and Associates, is based in Fitchburg. By way of full disclosure, we should mention that Freiberger Consulting is one of Wisconsin Public Radio's many business sponsors, and we certainly appreciate that. And appreciate you listening in, and Karen in Ripon has a question for you. John, let's go there. Hi, Karen.
I have, we had vinyl windows installed about 3 years ago. Okay. And the outside frame is wood, so they just installed the vinyl window in the old frame.
Mm-hmm.
They are leakier now than what our old windows were, but I switched from a crank out because the crank outs were no longer working, and we've got double hung and sliders.
Mm-hmm.
They're very leaky now. We called the contractor twice, and he said, well, we didn't close them tight enough, and we broke the lock. So I had him here three times, but he did nothing to replace them or fix them.
Yeah. How much money did you spend on this entire job, Karen?
Over $4,000.
Okay, so it's worth doing some investigation. Okay, here's what I would do. You need scientific proof that these windows leak around the edges and that's a bad installation. The way you're going to do that is you're going to call a home energy inspector. And what he's going to do, and you may as well have him do the whole energy inspection, he or she's going to charge you the same thing no matter what. But they are going to depressurize your house with a big fan that they put in your front door to 50 pascals, and then they're going to measure how much air is leaking, and with a smoke candle and other things, they can go to each window, and they can show you exactly what is leaking where. And you will then have a 12-page written report, and go to the contractor and say, these all need to come out again and be put in correctly. The other thing is, if you know the brand of the windows, you need to go to the manufacturers and get the installation instructions. So because you've got $4,000 already spent, I hate to tell you to spend another $500, but you're going to learn a lot of other things about your house and maybe some energy savings at the same time. So that's what I would advise doing. It's really hard to argue with a contractor because they're not going to believe you. But you've actually hired an expert who says the windows leak. It's pretty hard for them to argue against that.
Karen, there you go. Appreciate your call. Let's see. Sarah in Madison, your turn. Hi, Sarah.
Hi, Larry. I have a few spots of mold or mildew on my bathroom ceiling. I scrub them off regularly with bleach, and they keep coming back. How can I make them go away permanently?
I'm sorry, is this mold on the ceiling?
I think so.
Yeah, it probably is. Do you have a bath fan?
I do.
You do?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Do you know how much air it moves?
No, I don't.
Okay. The first thing to do is do the toilet paper trick. Tear a piece of toilet paper, turn on the fan, and if it won't hold the toilet paper up to the grill, it's not moving any air at all. What you may simply need is a lot of the bath fans that are out there at the big box stores are like 75 cubic feet per minute. And you have to run them for at least 15 minutes after you take a shower or a bath because they move so little air. When I was designing HVAC systems, I was putting in bath fans that were moving 200 to 250 cubic feet per minute. So what you have is you have got a lot of moisture in there. The ceiling is cool. It hits the dew point. Water condenses on the ceiling, and that feeds the mold. So we have to get the air out of there quicker and dry it out. So I would do the toilet paper test. You may have to talk to an HVAC contractor to put in a better fan or have an electrician put in a timer on the fan that you have and so that fan will turn itself off 10 minutes after you take a shower. See if that helps.
Yeah, yeah, that would be the cheapest way to resolve that issue.
Yes.
Emmy in Presque Isle. On to you. Hi, Emmy.
Hi, Larry. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
This is about a house that is in Pennsylvania, and I'm in Wisconsin, my brother's house. Okay, so it's just, I just texted him. It's 111 years old. the ceiling in one of the bedrooms, which is a room not used, has been falling down for mm-hmm. years in pieces.
Mm-hmm.
It's lathe and plaster.
Mm-hmm.
I know it's probably the original. And I'm concerned about, you know, just health reasons for this, mm-hmm. but also if it's better to replaster it, or take the whole ceiling down, replaster, or patch it up with drywall and plaster. I really mm-hmm. don't know.
Well, there's a lot of questions that your brother has to think about. One is, what is above this? Is there attic above it or a second floor?
It's it's a very old house. There's space, not really an attic. It's like there's space.
Okay,
above
crawl
there.
Space.
All right. So, all right. Here's a couple of things you need to think about. First is insulation. Number two is, why is the plaster falling off? If it's because it's just plain old and they've had leaks in the past, well, that's fine. That's maybe taken care of. If the room is 16 feet wide and the ceiling rafters are 2x4s, well, we've got a problem because the rafters are bending so much they're causing the plaster to break. So we need to have somebody look at your brother's house who actually can answer those sorts of questions. And again, sometimes the cheapest way of doing this, you can call a general contractor. They'll come out, sometimes not. But you can get a certified home inspector from the state of Pennsylvania. You download some in the area, call them, say, I got plaster falling down, I need to know why, and have them come and tell you. If it basically is just plain age, you can simply pop all the plaster off the ceiling, leave the lath, and you can re-plaster it with a two-coat or a three-coat system. Do not put drywall over the top of old plaster. So you're adding 1,000 pounds to the ceiling. So whatever mm-hmm. problem you have is now worse. So you can tear it all mm-hmm. off and put up drywall, or you can put new plaster on it. Sometimes the other thing you can do, and I've got a couple of good people here in Madison who do it, is you patch in the holes, you glue what looks like a screen mesh over the entire mm-hmm. ceiling, and then you put a thin coat of plaster, so you've replastered everything, and you've got the screen mesh to stop the cracks. So there's a lot of ways of doing it, but first discover, why do we have the problem? Then think of the possible solutions. Complete replacement with plaster, complete replacement drywall, patching with overcoat. So we've got at least four different options there.
All right. Emmy, good luck. Thank you very much for calling. And let's go to Karen in McFarland next. Hi, Karen.
Hi. We have radon in our basement. My husband has tested for it.
Mm-hmm.
And we know, and it's not extremely high, but it's higher than the limits.
Mm-hmm.
And we'd like to get it taken care of. But my question is, how do we find a good person for migrating this, a certified person,
yeah.
if he's got any advice on that?
Well, the first thing, what type of testing have you done, Karen? You didn't like 24-hour, 48-hour kits?
Yeah.
Okay. Those are highly inaccurate. It depends upon the air pressure outside, the amount of wind that's blowing or not blowing, the temperature, et cetera, et cetera. You could have a 2.3 one day and a 6.9 the next. So what I suggest you is go online and spend about $30, $35 and buy a six-month or one-year alpha tracker kit and put it in the basement. That will give you real figures. And I like to put them in from midsummer to midwinter or midwinter to midsummer, because you may find you've got no radon at all in the summer or none in the winter, but you do in the other seasons, or you do in days when the wind is blowing. But it'll average it all out and tell you how much of a problem that you have. Because radon mitigation is pretty tough. What most of the firms do is they cut a hole in your basement floor, they put a pipe into it, and they put a fan that removes air from under the basement floor. But if you've got a really big basement, I sort of wonder how much it's doing and how mm-hmm. many do we have to put in. It costs about $1,000 per penetration. So you could end up spending $4,000 or $5,000. So let's get some accurate numbers first and then determine who you're going to work with. There are some companies in Madison that have been in business. I know one of them has been in business for over 50 years. And find out how long they've been in business. If they've been in business for 40 to 50 years, you've got the right Madison area contractor.
All right. Karen, there you go. Thank you so much.
And let's go to Penny in Winona, Minnesota. Hi, Penny.
Hi. Good morning, Larry.
To you as
well. Go ahead.
No, that's okay. You go ahead.
Okay, so our issue is we purchased a very old farmhouse a couple years ago. My husband is a retired contractor who never does anything halfway. He does everything over the top, okay? So we replaced all the old windows. We did just go with vinyl windows from a very popular manufacturer who starts with the letter P, as in Paul. And he sealed everything, you know, Vicor tape, house wrap, caulk, I mean, like crazy. We cannot, these Asian lady beetles are still coming in like you wouldn't believe. Mm-hmm. Like, and where did they get in? I mean, you'll vacuum them up, and then next thing you look in 2 seconds later, and there's like a whole other crop. Is there anything to do?
Yes. This is a big problem. And generally what happens is they're coming in at the interface of the foundation and the wood sill of the house. Now, if you go to DuPont Tyvek or some other manufacturer and look at how you install the weather-resistant barrier, it says that you seal it to the foundation. In my many, many years of inspecting, I saw that done exactly once. The only reason I saw it done is I'd met with the contractor before, and I said, when I come back, I'm going to make sure that you seal this to the foundation. And he went, what? And his eyes got big. But he actually did it. So most likely what is happening is they're not coming in around the windows. If it is well seal taped, they should not be able to get through the windows, even though they're a vinyl window. So they are probably coming in to the basement. They are maybe going right up into the walls, crawling through the walls and coming out around the windows, because that's a penetration. So check with your husband and say, dear, did you remember to seal that weather-resistant barrier at the foundation?
And likely not. That's what the entomologists who I have on the show say, pretty much the same.
Oh, good. Wonderful.
There are also, you know, products you can put on in the late fall on the sunny side of the house, because that's where they're coming mm-hmm. up. And there's some products that'll stop them before they get there. But the timing on that has to be right. And then you have to do it every year. So why not fix it in the first place?
Right.
Yeah. Penny, there you go. Thank you for calling. Lee in Green Bay. We'll go to you now. Hi, Lee.
Yeah, the previous caller, in regards to like watching the contractor who does roofing, mm-hmm. I had problems with a contractor roughly over a year ago. They had to tear off roughly 15 sheets of my sheeting under, you know, the roofing mm-hmm. itself, because of water that penetrated. They never put H-clips on there.
Ah.
I had problems with that, but he gave me a 20-year warranty. But I question it with the crew that was here. Oh, no, you only have to have that for new construction. I thought, no, I don't think so.
No, we need the spacing, because most of our sheathing now is oriented strand board, and it expands and contracts with moisture. And if we don't have that spacing, what we end up is with ridges on our roof. So if you're out in your front lawn looking at your front roof and you've got an 8-foot or a 4-foot ridge, that is where your oriented strand board sheathing has expanded and has actually popped loose from the rafters or the trusses. So you are correct. It should have been put in. It's a pain, because the old space was 4x8, and now we're 4 4/16 or 4 1/8. So we actually have to take a saw and very carefully cut the sheathing that's still there, so we've got space for the H-clips. But that is the correct way of doing it. You are correct, Lee.
Thank you, Lee. Appreciate the call very much. Jane in Wausau emailed, they have an exterior metal door whose paint continues to blister, south-facing door, so in the winter it gets sun.
I would think it would get some sun in the summer, too. Jane's husband has several times sanded it down and repainted it. It's currently once again sanded down to bare metal, ready for a repaint. Suggestions on particular kinds of paint, perhaps color? How can they keep this from happening again?
Many metal doors actually have a wooden core. So take the door off the hinges. Pull the pins or unscrew the hinges if you have to, and so you can look at the bottom. If there's wood there, often what happens is that wood sucks up moisture, and then from the it ends up rusting from the inside. It's pretty rare that the metal door, unless it's an actual fire door, is solid metal. So make sure that all six sides of the door are correctly painted. Colored, who knows? But check with a local paint shop for a good primer. They have rusty metal primers, good, you know, plain non-rusty metal primers. But you're going to want to put a prime coat on, and again, we have to coat the bottom of the door as well as the sides, and then put on our acrylic latex or oil paint over the top of that.
Okay. All right. And let's see. We had another one here that I wanted to get to as well, and I can't find it right now. Okay. Here's... there's a bald, James emailed, there's a bald-faced hornet's nest attached to the LP smart siding on his house.
Mm-hmm.
Would it hurt the siding to leave it there, or should he take it down?
I know of absolutely nothing in the warranty or installation instructions from LP that deals with bald-faced hornets. I don't know whether bald-faced hornets, you know, re-inhabit or what. So I'm afraid it's difficult to answer that one. I mean, they're basically what they're putting up there is cellulose. They're putting it up in an area where it doesn't get rain, because if it did get rain, it'd fall apart. I think it's pretty much whatever James wants to do, whether he likes the look of the nest or he wants to get rid of it.
Yeah, and this probably would be the time to get rid of it before...
before they return, or whatever is left. I'm not an entomologist, so...
Stu emailed us. They have a 1945 home with two twirly bird vents on the roof, one of which has seized up. There's no soffit or gable venting. Is replacing the twirly bird adequate ventilation to do? They need something more, or do they need something more extensive, such as a ridge vent with soffit venting?
If they can put in soffit venting, that is where we really should start. The twirly birds, in theory, are more effective venting, but in reality, they aren't. And so they can, if they're old, they can just be replaced. And maybe they could just be replaced with the standard pot vents. But if you take a look at the Uniform Dwelling Code, you can actually ventilate an entire house with soffit venting. You don't need any upper venting. It is best to have upper venting, but of course, if you have a flat-roofed house, you have soffit venting. And the code gives you the proportions of that the venting should be. So I would have a contractor come in and put in soffit venting, maybe replace those two with simple pot vents, which should be fairly expensive, and that should actually make your attic a lot cooler in the summer and drier in the winter.
Dennis emailed us, is it ever logical to install new shingles on old shingles? What are the criteria?
Most manufacturers will allow one overlay. They will not allow two, but you have to go to the manufacturer's site. If you're putting on a really high-quality shingle, you like a GAF Timberline Plus, mm-hmm. that is a 40, 30, 40, 50-year shingle, I would take everything off. And part of it is that we are primarily protecting our sheathing with the underlayment. We have a lot of new underlayments now. I mean, the old felt, was 15-pound felt, was a wonderful underlayment, but... if it does get wet, we do get wrinkles in the roof. So if you're going with an expensive, long-lived roof, I would do everything. I would simply take everything off. That allows you then to check the condition of the sheathing as well, because we could have some decay in various places that are being hidden by the old shingles. And then we nail our new roof in, and it doesn't hold real well. So depending upon your investment, if you're making a big investment, do the whole investment.
Do the whole thing.
Make sure you get your money's worth.
Ralph and Hayward emailed us regarding a home inspection to determine leaks. How long after an inspection can a builder be held responsible? Their home was built in 2005, and at 10 years, many door frames seemed to leak. They were Marvin doors, with some showing mold at the base of the frames. They checked eventually with Marvin, but warranties had expired.
I think Marvin has a 10-year warranty on most things. Generally, after about 6 years, a builder, I think, in Wisconsin is pretty much off the hook. Now, I'm not an attorney.
Yeah.
I spend a lot of time with attorneys listening to them. But there's usually houses and projects have a one-year warranty, but then there's the thing called craftsmanship. So if somebody put in the windows and they forgot to water seal them on the outside, well, that's craftsmanship. But at this point, it's 2005. So I think there's really nobody responsible at this point. So much time has intervened, and you went back to the contractor, they'd just say, well, it's lousy maintenance, and they'd blame you. So I think, Ralph, diagnose the problem, figure out what you're going to do about it, but I'm afraid that the buck stops with you.
Valerie in Madison emailed us. They received recently came across a vinyl-like large tile 18 by 36 flooring called Micadur or UNICLIC Uniclick or and in parentheses they had Micadur. They had never seen this type of product before. It's a Swiss product. Are you familiar with it? And would you recommend it for inside flooring?
Well, I don't know what this is. Is this something that is glued down? Is this something that is a tongue and groove that is, I mean, a lot of our LVT floors now, Larry, we glue around the outer edges or don't even glue that so that it actually can move a little bit. So I think, Valerie, what you need to do is go to the manufacturer, take a look at installation instructions, take a look at the warranty, et cetera. And then, you know, the Madison area, there's a lot of very good flooring companies that are going to know about that. But you're in an area that is rich with, with the nuns and the Sojourners and all the rest. You're going to find somebody that has some experience on it if you call around. But do your research first so that you can ask intelligent questions.
And on that note, John, we are out of time. Thanks so much for stopping by again. You'll be back in 2 months.
Indeed I will, Larry.
And maybe we'll hear from, I forgot the guy who was going to call us back and let us know how things turned out.
Yes, on the insurance. And we had sort of some other questions, I think, in emails. And people, what you should do is call your insurance agent. That's his job. So if you've put in drain tile or you put a new roof on or you put in fireproof siding, call your agent, say, what can you do for me? That's their job.
John Freiberger, registered home inspector. And once again, by way of full disclosure, we should mention that Freiberger Consulting is one of Wisconsin Public Radio's many business sponsors, and we really appreciate it. We are going to turn our attention to collegiate women's hockey. We got some good news to talk about there. I'm Larry Mueller. Great to have you with us here on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. There's never been a better time, I don't think, to be a Wisconsin women's hockey fan. Our Division I and Division III teams both just won national championships. And today we're talking about the recent success of UW-Madison and the UW-River Falls women's hockey teams. And two guests for you. One, Joe Cranston, our guest. He's head coach of the UW-River Falls women's hockey team. Joe, thanks for joining us today.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. Appreciate the opportunity to talk about our season.
Yeah, it's really great to have you here. And Jackie Crum with us as well. She's the assistant coach of UW-Madison women's hockey team. Jackie, also a former player at UW-Madison. Jackie, thank you for joining us as well.
Thanks for having me.
You know, congratulations to you both. I mean, I was trying to think, I wonder if there's ever been a time when we've had, when any state has had a Division I, Division III national championships in the same sport. And in particular, women's, I can't imagine that was ever the case.
Yeah, I, not that I'm aware of. It's a pretty unique situation, but yeah, it might be a first.
Well, Joe, as long as you're talking there, it's been a few weeks since your team won the title. What moments from the championship match stick with you?
Well, our championship game was, it was all of our games in our tournament were sold out. So it was a full house and it was loud. And last year when we had the tournament, we were on spring break, so we didn't have the students. So it was quite an atmosphere, and it was a nail biter. And there was a time in the game where we scored to go up 2-0, and the refs talked about it, and then they got together and called it off. And I did a coach's challenge, and that was kind of the big highlight. And then they went and did a review on it. We won the challenge and went up 2-0, and the roof just about came off the rink. So that was a really exciting moment that I'll never forget.
Jackie Crum, what about you? What's your takeaway? What moment stands out for you?
Probably a pretty obvious one with the shootout goal with 18 seconds left in the game to tie it and then send it into overtime. And then obviously the overtime goal to win it all is pretty special. So pretty intense moments there.
Yeah. And it's interesting that both teams had coaches' challenges that wound up working out pretty darn well. And I imagine the media and the community, the communities have been very, very supportive. Joe, and you started to talk about that a bit in River Falls.
Yeah, it was, like I said, we sold out every game. There was one time where they managed to figure out the certain ticket allotments, and they got about an extra 240 tickets, and they went on sale, and they put it out that they're going to go on sale at 1 p.m. And they had 243 tickets, and they went on sale at 1 p.m. and they sold them all out in 4 minutes. So, you know, that's pretty impressive. And that says a lot about our community and how much support we had here. It was
And Jackie, I know the fans and the community here, the fans, it's really fun to go to one of your hockey matches because the fans are pretty rabid.
Yes, they are, and yeah, we sell out pretty much all of our games here in Wisconsin too. And just even being at the Frozen Four was amazing with the fan support. The semifinal game when we played Minnesota. Mm-hmm. I felt like they announced the starting lineup for Minnesota and that, you know, there was a big cheer, and then they announced our starting lineup. And then it seemed like all the Wisconsin fans were like, no, we can do better. And it felt like it was even louder than the Minnesota fans. So it was a pretty cool feeling. And then of course the final game, it felt like a home game. It just a sea of red and white and loud and exciting. And we're just so fortunate with the fans that we have.
I watched that final, and it was there were a couple of moments. It was so tense. I mean, as a fan watching it, I had to turn away from it for a minute or two here and there, just because I've got adrenaline running out of my fingernails here. What was it like? I could probably ask you both that. I mean, what was it like for you, Jackie, in that situation, that final game? Because it was touch and go, and two great teams. Joe had the same circumstance. What was it like?
I mean, you nailed it. It's intense. You have two, you know, high-end teams, and it's one game, and it's our third year in a row that we played them in the championship game. So, you know, it's going to be a battle, and obviously the score is tight, and You know, we pull our goalie and we, you know, have a pretty much a wide open net. We hit the goalie's goal pad. And then a few seconds later, we hit the post. And you're thinking at that time, you know, maybe it wasn't meant to be. And obviously the hand covering the puck was really in our favor and fortunate that happened. So, it's an intense game. I mean, obviously Joe can attest to that. When you're coaching in those games, I'm sure our heart rates are at 200 themselves and we're not even on the ice. But exciting, but you know, what an exciting time and how fortunate are we to experience, a national championship game.
Yeah. Well, now these two teams are really successful teams. And Joe, you've been doing it there for 26 years. This is this year, 26th year. Jackie, I think you've been there 16 years on staff, and you know before that you were a player and coach he's been there 20 years. How important is that sort of experience and having people who you know been there a while? How much a difference does that make? Go ahead.
Yeah, it's an advantage. I think, you know, as a coach, every year you're trying to get better and you need to get better. The game changes every year, so you have to adapt and change and be ahead of the game. But you stick with it and you stay at it. And if it's something you love to do, well, then you keep doing it. And I've had one of my assistant coaches about 10 years, another one about 16 years, and the other one's been with me from the start. And, you know, all of us are UW River Falls grads, and, you just do it for the love of the game and the love of the kids and just stick to it because it's a lot of fun and very rewarding.
Yeah. Jackie, what about you?
Yeah, I can piggyback with that. I think it's key. The consistency of the coaching staff, I think, attributes to a lot of success with that, too. Just, you know, that we've been together as a staff for quite a while as well. And I was a UW grad, coach was a UW grad, Dan was a UW grad. So, you know the ins and outs of the school and obviously the passion is there. When you're recruiting, we were all Badgers. Now, you know, we have the privilege to be working here. And so, like Joe, you know, you're trying to study the game and, you know, improve a little bit every year. And I think the experience also helps too, that, you know, it's not our first national championship game. We've been there before. We've been in pressure situations as a staff. Obviously that was an ending like we've never seen before, but I think all of that helps in the end.
And as long as I've got you on here, the Badgers ended their season with 221 goals. That's the most in school history. I'd say to Joe had, I think you were right at 200 or thereabouts, pretty darn close to 200 goals for the year yourself. Was that your record too, by the way, Joe?
I'm not sure. I don't know. I know we were the number one team in the country, and we averaged 6.1 goals a game offensively, so we scored a lot of goals.
oh my gosh. An email says, why? How can they score that many? I mean, why? What is it about the team or the players or the coaching that leads to that sort of success? Jackie.
Gosh, obviously it's a tribute to our players and, they obviously, who doesn't love scoring goals? So it's, they were on fire this year and, you know, a lot of times we can just sit back and watch, which is pretty nice. So, they enjoyed it. They enjoyed showing up to the rink every day, trying to improve, trying to get better. And I mean, with that is, you know, putting the puck in the net. And I think over time we had a little bit of a veteran team. And so their shots have improved, their accuracy has improved. And, it showed out on the ice.
And their passing. Mm-hmm. Their passing is really good, I think. And I haven't, Joe, I haven't had a chance to see your team in action other than the one video I watched. But just the puck and stick handling and puck handling and passing is just, for the Badgers, I know it's great. Is that something that you stress in your own coaching, Joe?
Yeah, I think we play a possession style of hockey a lot of the time. But yeah, our, you know, scoring goals is just, we just, you move the puck and move your feet and keep it simple. And we do that. And, you know, we get pucks deep when we need to, depending on what type of game it is. But we really move the puck well, and we don't really allow anybody to lug the puck up and down the ice and not to have superstars. And, you know, even though, you know, us and the Badgers both had the top player in the country, but scoring and that type of thing. But we move the puck, move your feet, go hard to the net, and yeah, you recruit good kids that, you know, like Jackie says, what don't you like about scoring goals? It's fun, and they like to do it. We're good at it.
Yeah, you both are indeed. Joe Cranston is the head coach at UW River Falls women's hockey team. Jackie Crum, assistant coach at UW Madison women's hockey team. She's also a former player. Great to have both of them with us. I can't remember if I gave the phone number. Let me do it right now if I haven't. Number to call. If you have a question or comment or about the teams or about women's hockey, I hope you'll join in. Number to call is 800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you along today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. We're talking with Joe Cranston, head coach at UW River Falls women's hockey team. Jackie Crum is the assistant coach of UW-Madison's women's hockey team as well, former player. Great to have them with us as we talk about how two Wisconsin women hockey teams took home the collegiate national titles this year. And again, number 800-642-1234 or email to talk@WPR.org. Love to hear from you. Junior Kirsten Sims, probably, well, I guess she was the star of the tournament in many ways, although she's got some great teammates, that was kind of picked by the team to take that penalty shot. And what led to that?
Well, I mean, obviously we had a penalty shot to take. And so you know, as a coach, you have, oh gosh, maybe 30 seconds to decide who's going to take it. And, you know, quickly we're discussing and, you know, going back and forth. And we know, you know, as a coach, you know, everybody's moves because you practice these shootout moves in practice all the time. And talking to coach, and we were talking about it, going back and forth, and then all of a sudden, you know, he kind of looks at the team, and obviously it's on camera. He says, "Who wants it?" And I think what you don't see on camera is that everyone's, you know, saying like, "Sims, you got this. Sims, you got this." So a lot of the teammates, you know, were obviously had a lot of faith in her and kind of encouraging her, and then that's when she put up her hand. And I think it was a natural choice. Obviously, you saw by her moves. So it's actually interesting because Teeley, the Ohio State goalie, is one of her teammates for the U.S. collegiate team. Mm-hmm. And so we were wondering, you know, do you pick somebody different who maybe doesn't know the move so well? So Sims's natural move is to go backhand. And she obviously surprised Teeley because she went back in and then pulled it forehand and had a wide open net. So, I mean, for her to, you know, one, have the confidence to do it, and then to, you know, beat Teeley at her own game is honestly remarkable. I mean, if you ask anyone out there, you have 18 seconds left, you're taking a penalty shot, and would you want to take it? I think the answer predominantly would be no. And so for her to step up and do that is incredible.
Jody, have a player or two on your team that would be willing and eager to do that? And if that was your situation?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we had a few shootouts this year. And Madison Katterlick usually goes first in those because she just shoots and scores pretty much every time. And, you know, we have Bailey Olson, who is the leading scorer in the country, and Megan Goodrow, second leading scorer in the country. And McKenna Ore is a defenseman for us. She's a junior. She's already a three-time All-American, and she can do amazing things too. So I wouldn't even be shy of throwing a defenseman in there. But it was certainly fun to see the Badgers do it the way they did this year. That was unbelievable.
Did you have a chance to see that championship game, Joe?
Yeah, I watched the entire thing. It was fantastic.
I did too, with the exception of a minute or two when I had to turn it off for my own sanity. You know, I was just thinking, as you mentioned recruiting, I think, earlier before our little break, and I remember coming back from Canada, I play in a golf tournament in Canada every year, pretty close to where you're from, Jackie, Waskasu. You probably know Waskasu.
I do. I've been there many times. That's fantastic.
I've been playing in this Buds tournament for a long, long time. But coming back one time, and this is a few years back, I was coming back on the plane, and there were some Canadians on the plane, and a couple of them had been looking at me, and I had Badger gear on. I had my Badger hat and, like, you know, a jacket. And one of them said, I bet you're recruiting hockey players from us, aren't you? And I said, no, I was just there for a golf tournament. But it got me thinking about recruiting. These are the premier, I mean, here are two premier programs. And I'm sure that comes with that is some help. When you're good already, recruiting people isn't going to be as difficult. But I'm wondering, Joe, let's start with you. Joe, for recruiting, how do you recruit? And I mean, the record that you've had over the years is fantastic. How does that play into it? And where do you recruit?
Well, the majority of our recruiting is in Minnesota because we're 20 minutes from, you know, from St. Paul. But we always have some Wisconsin kids on our team. We've had as many as 8 Wisconsin kids a few years ago. We had a few this year, 2 this year, and we have 1 from California. Otherwise, the majority of our players on this year's team anyway, it does vary. We have a lot of Minnesota kids, but the fact that when you have success, you know, success breeds success. And, you know, over this year and last year, we're 57-3-2. So, you know, the juniors that we're recruiting right now, you know, it definitely, that helps, because when they, you know, we're close enough, most of them are from Minnesota. We get a lot of northern Minnesota kids too, but, you know, they're close enough. They just come, they came to our games, came to the Frozen Four, the national championship game here, and, you know, they're close, so they get to see those games, and, you know, you get to see that, and it's like, yeah, who, you know, who wouldn't want to be a part of that? It's a crazy fun environment, and you don't get to have that everywhere you go, D1 or D3.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Jackie, what about your situation? You're really good, but there's a lot of other really good teams and schools out there too. So it's not just a piece of cake or a walk in the park.
No, I wish it was, but no, it's not at all. I mean, obviously, like Joe said, you know, success breeds success. So the nice thing is that we're at least in the mix with some of the top players in the country, US, Canada, around the world, which is fantastic, but doesn't necessarily mean that they're going to say yes to Wisconsin. So a lot of hard work, a lot of relationship building, you know, a lot of time spent on the road watching these players, watching their development throughout high school. It never really ends. Lots of phone calls, texting. I would say it's just a huge part of the game, or a huge part of my job is just being on the road recruiting and building these relationships, and obviously just finding the right pieces to the puzzle too. Just because you're good doesn't mean that maybe, you know, you'll necessarily fit in with the team or just kind of our style of play or what we're trying to do here. So there's a lot of background work involved as well.
Yeah, and I was actually thinking of, I read a story about one of the gals who was played for Ohio State, played for Wisconsin, but left to go to Ohio State because they had women's lacrosse, I believe, or something.
Field hockey.
Field hockey, that, and she really wanted to play field hockey. So I'm sure she was pretty happy playing hockey for the Badgers, but that other sport called, and so that moved her to Ohio State.
Correct, yep.
Does anything, I mean, what about you and retaining players and keeping them? Is there much of an issue for you?
No, I don't think we've really lost maybe one player in the last 10 years, actually. We bring in five or six or seven every year, and we graduate five or six or seven every year. We don't traditionally lose any players. So we have a really good retention rate here, and I think that says a lot about the culture here and how much fun it is and how much success we have.
Yeah, and I've watched the kids on both teams women on both teams being interviewed, and I'm always impressed by how composed they are and how well they speak about their team and their community. And it's kind of inspiring, actually. And they all look like leaders to me. Do you look for leaders?
Yeah, I mean, that's obviously a nice quality to have, for sure. I mean, when you're recruiting players and, you know, high-end players that are, you know, wearing a C for their club team or their high school team, definitely a lot of the leadership qualities are qualities that, you know, you would like to have as players on your team, for sure.
Yeah. And Joe, I'm sure it's the same for you. Here's an email. When you win a championship, you might have a target on your back. And how did you push through the adversity and pressure to follow up and win that second title? Adversity is the word.
Right. I think we always have a target, you know, just like the Badgers always have a target because, you know, we've won our conference, you know, almost every year for over a decade. So you have that target, but then like last year we were undefeated national champions, and with that brought even a way bigger target, and everybody was out to get us, and we had this winning streak and unbeaten streak that were set records in all of D3 women's hockey in the history of the sport. So yeah, everybody was really coming after us, and you know, you'd look traditionally a lot of teams when they have that kind of success, there's a lot of times historically that you kind of tank it the next year. So that put a little stress into me. I just wanted to make sure that didn't happen and that we didn't think we were that good. We just had to get back to work.
An email from Michelle. Her daughter was with the UW marching band, performed at every kind of athletic event. She says she and the band feel most appreciated by the women's hockey team. She wanted to say thanks to the coaches and the staff,
And thanks to you both for being with us today. Here we are out of time. Joe Cranston, head coach at UW River Falls women's hockey team. Jackie Crum, the assistant coach at UW Madison's women's hockey team, and a former player as well. And from an area of Canada that I like a lot, as a matter of fact. Thank you all for listening. Please stay with us. Lots more in store here on WPR News. I'm Larry Mueller.